The typical computer programmer is a man, a young man. That's just a reality right now. Tech companies recently revealed how few of their female employees worked in programming and technical jobs. Google was among the highest, with 17%. It would be easy to assume it's always been that way, but it has not. Decades ago, women pioneered computer programming. And in today's installment of The Changing Lives of Women, we will hear what those women did and why more women did not follow. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
I took a trip to Stanford University, ground zero for today's computer revolution. I figured if any group of random students would know about the pioneers of computer programming, I'd find them here.
Who were the first people who programmed computers? Do you know?
No, I don't think so.
I have no idea.
No. I don't.
I'm in computer science. This is so sad.
That was Ansuman Pradhan, Deshae Jenkins, Anthony Carrington, and Stephanie Pham. Of the more than a dozen students I interviewed, I got a couple close calls. Here's one of them, Chengdao Fan.
It's a woman, probably.
Yeah,
and she's... it's not necessarily electronic computer. I think it's more like a mechanic computer.
She's thinking of Ada Lovelace, also known as the Countess of Lovelace, born in 1815. Walter Isaacson begins his new book, The Innovators, with her story.
Ada Lovelace is Lord Byron's child, and her mother, Lady Byron, did not want her to turn out to be like her father, a romantic poet.
So Lady Byron
had her tutored almost exclusively in mathematics, as if that were an antidote to being poetic.
Lovelace saw the poetry in math. At 17, she went to a London salon and met Charles Babbage. He showed her plans for a machine which he believed would be able to do complex mathematical calculations. He asked Lovelace to write about his machine for a scholarly journal. In her article, Lovelace expresses a vision for his machine that goes beyond calculations.
That a computer can do anything that can be noted logically. In other words, words and pictures and music, not just numbers. Secondly, she understands how you take an instruction set and load it into the machine. And she even does an example, which is programming Bernoulli numbers, an incredibly complicated sequence of numbers.
Babbage's machine was never built. But his designs and Lovelace's notes were read by people building the first computer a century later, though the women who would program one of the world's earliest electronic computers knew nothing of Lovelace and Babbage. As part of the oral history project of the Computer History Museum, Jean Jennings Bartik recalled she was doing calculations on rocket and cannon trajectories by hand in 1945, a job open to work on a new machine.
This announcement came around that they were looking for operators of a new machine they were building called the ENIAC. So, of course, I had no idea what it was.
Bartik was one of six women mathematicians who created programs for one of the world's first fully electronic general-purpose computers, the ENIAC. Isaacson says the men didn't think this was an important job.
Men were interested in building the hardware, you know, doing the circuits, figuring out the machinery. And women were very good mathematicians back then.
Isaacson says in the 1930s, women math majors were fairly common, though most of them went off to teach. But during the Second World War, these skilled women signed up to help with the war effort. In front of a live audience at the Computer History Museum in 2008, Jean Bartik recalled that the job lacked prestige. The ENIAC wasn't working the day before its first demo. Bartik's team worked late into the night and got it working.
They all went out to dinner and at the announcement, and we weren't invited, and there we were. People never recognized. They never acted as though we knew what we were doing. I mean, we were in a lot of pictures.
Though at the time, media outlets didn't name the women in the pictures. After the war, Bartik and her team went on to work on the UNIVAC, one of the first major commercial computers. The women joined up with Dr. Grace Hopper, a tenured math professor who joined the Navy Reserve. Walter Isaacson says Hopper had a breakthrough. She found a way to program computers using words rather than numbers, most notably a program language called COBOL.
Because you would be using a programming language that would allow you almost to just give it instructions almost in regular English, and it would compile it for whatever hardware it happened to be. So that made programming more important than the hardware.
Hopper retired from the Navy Reserve as a Rear Admiral, a An act of Congress allowed her to stay past mandatory retirement age. She did become a public figure. Hopper even appeared on David Letterman in 1986.
But you're known as the queen of software. Is that right?
But it was also just about this time that the number of women majoring in computer science began to drop, from close to 40% to around 17% now. It was around this time that Steve Jobs and Bill Gates were appearing in the media. Personal computers were taking off. Computer science degrees got more popular. Boys who had been tinkering with computer hardware at home looked like better candidates to departments than girls who liked math. That's according to Janet Abate, a professor at Virginia Tech who has studied this topic.
It's kind of the classic thing. You pick people who look like, you know, what you think a computer person is, which is probably a teenage boy who was in the computer club in high school.
And for decades, the women who pioneered the computer revolution were often overlooked, but not in Isaacson's book about the history of the digital revolution.
When they have been sort of written out of the history, you don't have great role models. But when you learn about the women who programmed ENIAC or Grace Hopper or Ada Lovelace, it happened to my daughter. She read about all these people when she was in high school, and she became a math and computer science geek.
Ada Lovelace, the mathematician, died when she was 36. The women who worked on the ENIAC have all passed away, as has Grace Hopper. But every time you write on a computer, play a music file, or add up a number with your phone's calculator, you are using tools that might not exist without the work of these women. Isaacson's book reminds us of this fact, and perhaps knowing that history will show a new generation of women that programming is for girls. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
Big data knows you better than your own mother. It knows what you're going to do even before you do it. That's what predictive analytics is all about. It's the way all sorts of companies search through huge amounts of data and make predictions. So Amazon can figure out what you want to buy next. Netflix knows what you want to watch next. And Target could know if you're pregnant. In the world of venture capitalism, some investors have been using the technique to figure out which startups are likely to make it big. Now one firm is taking it one step further, or actually backwards, using an algorithm to try to find promising entrepreneurs before they even start a company. Roy Bahat is the head of that venture capital firm, Bloomberg Beta. Bahat says the competition to buy up entrepreneurs is that intense.
There are so many companies being started and so many people trying to back those companies that if you don't start earlier, sometimes you feel like you're speaking to somebody after they're already well on their way.
So how did this idea come together?
You know, we'd seen some reports in the news about companies using data in new ways. Mm-hmm. And then we were sitting there talking to entrepreneurs and they'd come into our offices after they'd already done all this thinking about what they wanted to do. And we just thought, wouldn't it be better if we could see them 6 months earlier or a year earlier? And part of the problem is then they may not have themselves even known that they wanted to start a company. And so we started asking the question of, could we try to use data to predict who would start a company before they did?
So what data are you analyzing? What are the features that you're looking for?
We mostly look at their work history and their educational history, their public presence. And from that, you can deduce a lot. You know, for example, if somebody's ever worked at a startup that's backed by venture capitalists, then they're much more likely to start a startup in the future because that's the world they've seen.
And can you give me like a basic profile of this type?
Well, so you know what's interesting is we have in our minds this stereotype of what a typical entrepreneur looks like. Mm-hmm. And the reality is the people who start companies are incredibly varied. Roughly 40% of the people we identified were 40 years of age or older, All genders, all professional backgrounds. And so that's the amazing thing is when you use the data, some of your stereotypes just turn out to be wrong. And that's great because it means you're talking to people that the traditional system overlooks.
So you came up with a list of individuals. How many people did you end up with?
We came up with 350 people. They got this message from us saying, hey, we did this study, and based on, you know, public data about you, we've concluded that you are likely to be a founder of a startup in the future. And honestly, we had to email some people a few times because several people thought it was a scam.
It sounds a little bit like...
Yeah, I mean, somebody wrote us back and said, if this is a scam, it's the most elaborately well-organized one I've ever seen. You know, and all we were offering them was a chance to get to know one another and get to know us. And so we've hosted a series of events where we've talked to them about the process of starting a company, and our goal was just to get to know them.
We decided to reach out to one of those 350 targeted future founders that Roy Bahat and his team have gotten to know. The algorithm looked at candidates in New York and Silicon Valley. Emoju Miller is a PhD candidate at UC Berkeley.
I got an email, very random email, from Bloomberg Beta.
She thought it was just another networking event, so she forwarded the email to some friends and invited them to go with her.
One of my friends emailed me back and said, I think you ought to read this email a little bit closer. Don't think it's a regular networking event.
Once she realized what they were after, she was intrigued.
And I did a cursory analysis of my own and realized that there's several things that I have in common with whoever potentially is the prototype of a startup founder.
Miller is getting a PhD in computer science and education. She has a job with Google's nonprofit wing advising startups. And, way to go, algorithm, she was planning to become an entrepreneur.
Probably within the next 36 months, I intend to start a startup of my own. It will be something in the ed tech space. I'm not quite sure the scale of the problem I want to solve. That's why I'm not rolling out and creating one now.
Emoju Miller says the outreach firm Bloomberg Beta didn't really influence her entrepreneurial goals, but it did one thing for her.
It just kind of validated me to know that I'm not crazy. It's like, okay, these are your people.
But the response from candidates that Bloomberg Beta found have been mixed, says the company's leader, Roy Bahad.
You know, as you might expect with any group, some people are completely disinterested and probably hit delete every time it hit their inbox. And other people are really honored that they were tapped on the shoulder this way. Some of the folks that we identified in our study already went and started companies. You know, one just got millions of dollars of venture funding. You know, my view is the real success is only going to be judged over a period of years as we see how these people's careers unfold and our relationships with them unfold.
Do you think this process in the venture capital world is going to become the norm?
There is no question. I mean, I am a believer that the things that we see in science fiction, you know, eventually come to pass. And if you've seen Minority Report, where, you know, the precogs go grab the criminals before they even know they want to commit the crime, you know, that kind of a future is, for better and for worse, coming. And so I think that'll happen in agriculture, industry, human relations, sports. I mean, name an industry, the data are coming.
Roy Bahad leads the venture capital firm Bloomberg Beta. Roy, thanks for your time today.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for looking into this.
This year, Visa and MasterCard together will handle transactions worth $3.5 trillion in the United States alone, millions of cards swiped billions of times. An alternative method is just a fraction of the market right now. It is sometimes possible to make electronic payments with smartphones, but that method has less than half of 1% of the market, even though big brands like Apple and PayPal are trying. NPR's Steve Henn is tracking why that is and what might change. Hi, Steve.
Good morning.
So I can use my phone as a radio, as a game center, as an airline boarding pass. What's keeping it from easily being a credit card?
Really, success in this field has always been all about winning over merchants. And for years, merchants, store owners, have been eager for tech companies to come into this industry and compete with Visa and MasterCard. They were hopeful that tech companies would find a way to drive down transaction fees, the swipe fees. So when you bought that bagel this morning, your bank and the card company probably got around 2% of that transaction. And when you're talking about $3.5 trillion, that comes to $70 billion in fees each year.
You would think that tech companies would be doing everything possible to get a larger slice of that then. What's stopping them?
Well, it turns out that keeping track of tens of billions of transactions down to the penny is actually really hard. Clearing those transactions, advancing that much credit, detecting fraud. Visa, MasterCard, and the banking system are really very efficient at this. So when most tech companies have tried to get into this business, they don't try to reinvent that wheel. Instead, they've built their payment platforms on top of Visa and MasterCard. So for merchants, if there's a new high-tech payment option out there, typically there's another company in the loop in that transaction looking for a slice of your sale.
So merchants were hoping to get a better deal, and instead now they're paying two companies a percentage of the transactions they're getting.
Right. And so some tech companies have actually been able to gain some ground by focusing on little businesses. But if you're a huge company, a Walmart or a Home Depot, and you have thousands of cash registers, why would you spend millions of dollars to upgrade your equipment so another company could charge you more? Fundamentally, that's why this kind of technology didn't go anywhere for years.
Well, what, if anything, would make that change?
Honestly, credit card fraud. Something like half of all card fraud in the world happens in the United States because we still have this antiquated credit card system that relies on magnetic strips fixed card numbers, and signatures. You know, it's not hard to make a fake card if you steal someone's credit card numbers. And most countries have switched to a different system that uses a microchip embedded in the card itself and often requires a PIN code. This system is finally about to come to the U.S. Card companies have announced that beginning in October 2015, any merchant that's still using the old-fashioned swipe and sign credit card will be liable for fraudulent transactions at their store. But if they get new credit card processing machines, they won't be liable. And that means millions of businesses are out there shopping for new credit card terminals.
Terminals that might be compatible with a smartphone and create an opportunity.
Well, that is what businesses like Apple are hoping. And what's interesting about what Apple's doing is they've convinced the banks not to raise merchant fees if they accept their phones as a payment.
Well, okay, if the credit system is not going to take a larger slice of money from my transaction when I bought that bagel, how is Apple going to make money here?
They've convinced banks to share their fees. And I think the reason banks are willing to do this is they're hoping that Apple's system, which uses a unique credit card number for every transaction, will actually cut down on fraud.
Well, we'll see where this goes next. NPR Steve Henn, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
This is NPR News. It's customary in radio not to overload you with too many numbers. They get hard to follow and recall, so better to avoid a lot of little numbers and limit yourself to the really strikingly large ones.
I'd say these numbers qualify, 76 million and 7 million.
Those are big numbers. 76 million households were affected by this summer's data breach at the banking giant J.P. Morgan Chase.
So were 7 million small businesses. NPR's Sonari Glinton has more on the story.
Just a few short sentences in a filing with the government is how J.P. Morgan Chase let the world know the extent to which it was hacked. The bank says hackers got away with contact information like names, addresses, emails, phone numbers, and not things like account numbers and Social Security numbers.
Well, there's no doubt that companies with valuable information have a target painted on them.
Jonathan Mayer is a cybersecurity fellow at Stanford. He says almost any information from a bank of Chase's size can have value.
It's a little different from robbing a bank, where you kind of presumably would start with the gold and then go from there. When you're robbing an online bank, you take everything you can get and sort through what you got later.
Mayer says it's nearly impossible to catch the bandits as they're most likely stationed outside the U.S. Meanwhile, J.P. Morgan Chase says customers aren't liable for any unauthorized transactions, and it's detected no fraud related to the breach so far. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
The year of enormous data hacks continues. America's biggest bank, J.P. Morgan Chase, revealed yesterday that 76 million households were hit in a data breach this past summer. Before that, hackers broke into Home Depot, Target, eBay. The list goes on. So is this just the new normal? NPR's Elise Hu joins us now to talk about the latest in a string of hacks on financial systems. Hi, Elise.
Hey there, Rachel.
Any more details about this particular breach?
Chase isn't saying much. They're not saying how hackers managed to get such wide access, but Bloomberg is reporting that the original access point came by getting a password from an employee. This hack then went unnoticed from June until August until they disclosed it. And it's taken a couple of months for Chase to actually work out the details of the investigation to know this scope. The bank says hackers were able to get contact information like addresses and emails, but not bank account logins. So it is saying your money is safe. What's puzzling about this is that even though the hackers reportedly did get into dozens of servers and obtain that highest level of admin privilege,
yeah,
they somehow weren't able to crack the account side of the servers.
So what does this mean for customers out there who hear this and are still really apprehensive? What else can they do to protect themselves?
Well, because hackers have email addresses, beware of any phishing emails. That means don't click on links from email addresses you don't know or links inside messages that might look like they're from Chase or another trusted source, but are slightly off. Chase is saying you don't need to change your password or your bank account information, but there's plenty of us who've actually already done that lately because of the string of retail hacks.
Yeah. As you say, this is a string of hacks. It just seems to keep happening. Target's breach affected up to 110 million customers. Home Depot's affected 56 million cards. NPR has reported on the Neiman Marcus breach and the one at eBay. And now we're talking about the country's biggest bank. So do customers just have to get used to a certain level of risk?
Even the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, admits a kind of resignation about these data hacks. He wrote to investors that while banks have shored up their security, of course, the battle is, quote, continual and likely never ending.
But that means companies must be doing something to try to prevent these breaches from happening. What can they do?
Certainly, they're shoring up their security by spending a lot of money. JP Morgan, in particular, has said it plans to spend $250 million a year on digital security. And the hacks on retailers, of course, have really strengthened this movement to get onto more secure payment systems like mobile payment. Apple Pay is going to be coming out October 20th. That technology will let you pay for things by simply waving your iPhone near a cash register.
NPR's Elise Hu, she covers technology and culture. Thanks so much, Elise.
You're welcome.
A new social network is getting a lot of attention. It's called Ello, like the word hello pronounced by Eliza Doolittle. A big part of its appeal is that it's not Facebook. The site promises not to sell information about you or to bombard you with ads. If you go to the site, it looks like the internet made with a typewriter and some Polaroids, just text and pictures. The CEO of Ello, Paul Budnitz, told NPR the company is getting 40,000 signups and requests per hour. We wondered whether anyone really can dethrone Facebook or even compete as an alternative. We've called Howard Rheingold. He teaches virtual communities and social media at Stanford. He also coined the term virtual community. He's basically a Jedi master in this world. I asked him whether there is an appetite for social networks that won't sell your personal data or track your movements.
We're noticing things, of course. You know, when you use Gmail, it's sometimes unnerving how relevant the ads are in the margin. And you might shop for something somewhere and decide not to buy it and then see an ad for it on Facebook. So I think that there's a growing awareness of the degree to which people are being tracked. So yes, there is a great appeal to something that promises not to sell your data and bombard you with ads. I wonder, though, about after a lot of people join it, whether they're going to continue to participate. Because I know that there was something called PATH. I don't know how many years ago, 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago, that offered an alternative to Facebook. And I joined it like a lot of other people. And like a lot of other people, I don't use it anymore.
Have you joined Ello yet?
I have not joined Ello. I got an invite and I decided that I've got enough happening online.
I made the exact same decision. I got an invite this week and I ignored it.
It's pretty noisy out there.
And how much of a risk is that for anyone who tries to enter this already saturated online space?
You've got to do something to rise above the noise. I think Ello has done what any social application that wants to succeed does, which is they seed it with people that they believe are going to influence others.
And that's why it's membership by invitation only, at least for now.
Instagram started by invitation only. There's something that chaos scientists called sensitive dependence on initial conditions. The first folks who start using it and the people they tell are sort of the DNA of a social network. Remember, Facebook started at Harvard, Princeton, and Stanford. So they had the cachet of the elite colleges. And of course, students from other colleges wanted to join.
You know, I actually remember a conversation from long ago when Friendster was dying, and I asked somebody, I need to create a profile on MySpace or Facebook, but I don't know which one. What should I do? And he said, Facebook is for college graduates. MySpace is for other people. And if that's true, then who are the Ello people?
That's a very good question. I don't know that they're the super elite, the super rich. There was a social network for the super rich that was started years ago called A Small World. Of course, A Small World is for the 1%. Maybe the 0.1% have one that nobody but them ever hears about.
Howard Rheingold, a member of the 99% and author of many books about social media and virtual communities, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.